Good evening and welcome to tonight's monthly teleconference. All lines are currently in a listen-only mode. During the presentation, we will conduct several question and answer sessions. If you would like to ask a question, press 1 on your touch-tone keypad. Please try to ask questions that are general in nature and that might appeal to the larger group. Once your question is asked, your line will be remuted. Questions will be taken in the order that they are received. I would now like to turn the conference over to Ms. Piper Reynolds, Senior Manager of Programs for the National MS Society Greater Northwest Chapter. Piper, you may begin.
Thank you, Alma, and thank you, everyone, for registering for our regional teleconference this evening. We're really excited to have you on the line for this very interesting topic. This teleconference is one of the many free and helpful programs and services available to people living with MS through the National MS Society. From support groups to care management, financial assistance to political advocacy, we are here to help and partner with you. Whether you are a person living with MS, a friend, or a caregiver, the National MS Society is here to connect you to the information and resources you need. Contact us by calling 1-800-344-4867. Tonight's teleconference will discuss mothers and aspiring mothers living with MS. MS is more prevalent in women of childbearing age than in any other group. When young women receive a diagnosis of MS, they frequently have questions about the effects of the disease on childbearing and vice versa. Studies undertaken over the past several decades allow health professionals to provide answers to some of these questions. Tonight's interactive teleconference will examine the impact of MS on pregnancy and reproductive issues. Our featured speaker this evening is Dr. Sylvia Lucas. Dr. Lucas is the Clinical Professor of Neurology and Rehabilitation Medicine at the University of Washington Medical Center. She is Director of the Headache Clinic and Neurology Director of the Western MS Center. She is past President of the Puget Sound Neurologic Society and a member of the American Academy of Neurology, Consortium of MS Centers, American Headache Society, International Headache Society, National Headache Foundation, and Washington State Medical Association. She is a former trustee of the Greater Washington Chapter of the National MS Society, and she is the editor of the MS Alliance newsletter. Her research interests are in headache and multiple sclerosis. Following this teleconference, you will receive an email or a letter if you don't have email containing additional information about this evening's topic, as well as other programs and services available to you through the National MS Society. And so on that note, I thank you again for being on the call this evening, and I'd like to pass it off to Dr. Lucas. You may begin, Dr. Lucas.
Thank you, Piper, and welcome and good evening, everyone. I'd like to thank the National MS Society for inviting me to participate in this teleconference entitled Mothers and Aspiring Mothers with MS. I'm really happy to be able to talk about this. My practice has included many women for the past 20 years. As you know, MS is more likely to hit young women over men, and the usual ages are 20, 30 to 40. So many young women who are thinking about having children and may have MS are typically in that age where you're trying to make those decisions on whether a pregnancy fits into your lifestyle, whether you want to have children at all, and whether you're in a relationship or not in a relationship. And, you know, again, everybody faces these issues. And a lot of these issues we're going to talk about tonight, particularly at the end of the teleconference, are things you have to ask yourself whether you have multiple sclerosis or not. But, of course, I'm going to be talking about MS and particularly pregnancy and post-pregnancy issues primarily. But a lot of couples with MS will come in and basically ask, well, should we have children? And what's the risk of passing MS on to my child? And you know, a little bit about genetics before we go on. I mean, you don't pass multiple sclerosis on to your child like you would hair color and eye color. There is a small risk. For example, the risk of a sibling of having MS, if one sibling has MS, is about 3 to 5%. The risk if a parent has MS to the child is still about 3 to 5%. So it's a low risk. and even in identical twins. So basically two human beings that are clones of each other, if one twin has MS, the risk for the second sibling is still less than 50%. So it's maybe about in the 40% range. And of course, you know that there's an environmental risk with the Pacific Northwest tending to have a bit higher prevalence rate of multiple sclerosis. A lot of people have asked about vitamin D and whether that relates to having MS, but so far there's been no definitive studies that women with low vitamin D's may have an increased risk or pass on an increased risk to their children. And there have been studies looking at the vitamin D levels of children born to mothers with MS, and there hasn't been any difference in the vitamin D levels in those children versus children that are born to moms without MS. Now, there are other questions, for example, financial issues, and this doesn't necessarily have to go to a question that has to go to people with MS, but right now maybe there's two jobs and two incomes in the family, and people have to sort of look at the fact of could we live on one job, one income? What kind of house do we need to be in? Can we stay in our home? And again, that's something, if you live in an apartment, it may be an issue. So maybe we need a one-bedroom. Maybe we need to go up to a two-bedroom. How can I take care of my spouse and a child? How is this going to affect your life? Again, some of these issues are issues in general, and some are going to have to do with MS in particular. So I want to move on to talking about pregnancy and multiple sclerosis. And it certainly is an important decision, and I think that the decision to become a parent, of course, should be made irrespective of whether multiple sclerosis is in the picture or not. Yes, MS may bring up problems that you don't face if you don't have MS. But the really important issue is, do I want to have a child? Do I want to bring up a child in this environment, in this society? Am I ready to make the sacrifices in my life that it would take to have a child? So it's a very important decision. And for all of us, we really don't know what the future is going to be like. If you have MS, you know more about your future, perhaps, than if you don't have MS, but it doesn't mean you can't get hypertension, diabetes, cancer. So there are other things that may come into your life, and, of course, anybody would have a backup plan for a pregnancy, godparents, next of kin, et cetera, and that's irrespective of whether you have MS or not. So on that bright note, let me talk about pregnancy and MS. And the good news about pregnancy and MS is that pregnancy not only appears to be fine in patients with MS, but actually, as many of you heard, is an immune-protected state. And many women do better being pregnant if they have MS than if they're non-pregnant. One of the studies, and it was really a fantastic study that was done years ago before many people were on disease-modifying therapy, was known as the PRIMS study. This was a pregnancy relapse in MS study, and it was the study investigator was located in France and in the European Union at that time. Even though disease-modifying therapies were available, there weren't very many women on there. So most of these women have not been on disease-modifying therapy. So let me tell you a little bit about this study before I tell you the results. This was a one-year study, and it took women before pregnancy and followed them during pregnancy and then after pregnancy. As it was a one-year study, it was broken up into 4 months before pregnancy, three trimesters during pregnancy and then four trimesters after pregnancy. So it was 3-month period before, during, and after pregnancy. The total number of pregnancies was 227 that resulted in a live birth. Now, when they followed the relapses that each woman had before pregnancy, these are averages, and there were big ranges, but most women averaged anywhere from maybe 0.4 to 0.8 relapses per woman per year, meaning that on average, every 2 years, one relapse might occur in each woman. But again, this is an average. So when these women got pregnant, what happened is if you look at an average rate of 0.8 relapses per year in each woman, in the first trimester, it dropped to about 0.4 and stayed that way until the third trimester, where it dropped to 0.2. So it steadily decreased. It didn't go to zero, but it went down really quite low. And then within the first trimester after delivery, it tended to rebound up to 1.2 and then do the steady drop till about 1 year after the pregnancy. So what that tells us is that during that immune protected state during pregnancy, the relapse rate goes down. And it has a little bit of an overshoot that occurs at 3 months after delivery. And then it drops down, and you're pretty much at the pre-pregnancy rate at 1 year. What they also did, besides looking at relapses, is to look at the MRIs. And they took two women that volunteered to have MRIs done on a monthly basis. Isn't that fun? And, of course, they did not use gadolinium. They didn't want anything that could harm the fetus. And there's some question about are magnetic fields okay for a pregnant child, but this was a very low low-strength scanner. And it looks like there were active lesions, meaning since they didn't use gadolinium, the way they defined active lesions were new lesions or lesions that were getting bigger. And they found that the new or larger lesions dramatically decreased during pregnancy. And they returned postpartum. So after delivery, again, you had the same increase within the first trimester, and then it would subsequently go down. So the MRI activity seemed to match the clinical activity. So the bottom line then is with this study that really reflects what most MS specialists' clinical experience has been, is that MS has no effect on the course of pregnancy or the outcome of pregnancy. So that they looked at that. The course of pregnancy was just the same if you did or you didn't have MS. And the live births, there was no increase in adverse events in women that have had MS or didn't. MS has no effect on the fertility rate, that is, the ability to get pregnant. It had no effect on the rate of miscarriages. It was the same whether women had MS or they didn't have MS. It had no effect on prematurity rates. It had no effect on toxemia or eclampsia or pregnancy-induced hypertension. It had no effect on the course of labor or delivery. It had no effect on head circumference or birth weight, and no effect on infant mortality or congenital malformations. So, the message to those of you that would like to become pregnant or are future moms is it has no effect on the course or outcome. And again, remember that this is in a population, a study population of almost 300 women. There may be some individual variations, but pregnancy is a time that many people can be at risk for medical conditions. So if you're considering pregnancy, it's always really good. I mean, it's like practicing for the triathlon. If you want to, you know, get ready to do that, I mean, you're going to get on the stair stepper, you're going to eat right, you're going to bicycle, you're going to swim. Well, if you're going to get pregnant, it's good to take folic acid at least a year prior to pregnancy. Make sure your vitamin D level is fine. Make sure you're eating right. Make sure your weight is a reasonable. Obviously, if you're hypertensive or you have a tendency to be diabetic or hyperglycemic prior to pregnancy, this is something that you're going to have to talk to your doctor about, because, you know, pregnancy can worsen some of these conditions. So pregnancy appears to suppress MS with a postpartum rebound. Another message to future moms is that the medication should be discontinued during pregnancy. There's no apparent teratogenic effect of the medicines, and I'm gonna circle back to that in a minute. And we recommend starting or reinstituting as soon as possible after delivery. I have a lot of people interested in that, so I want to kind of circle back to that and talk about, you know, when do you stop medicines? You know, obviously, you can't get pregnant the minute you decide on it, and there can be, you know, anywhere from a month or, I just breathed pregnancy and it happened, to, you know, a year or more. And the longer you've been on oral contraceptives, for example, there's some evidence that says it might take you a little bit longer to get pregnant. The older you are, the closer you are to your mid to late 30s, getting closer to 40, much more difficult or taking longer to achieve a pregnancy. So we never really know when that's going to happen. If we ask a woman to stop her disease-modifying therapy, whether it's Tysabri or Copaxone or the interferons, we ask at least to stop for a month. Now, with the platform medications, the Copaxone and the interferons, we have the most experience with those, and a month is probably okay. Now, what happens if you get pregnant accidentally or before you stop your medication? Well, there's been a lot of data collected primarily during clinical trials when women have inadvertently gotten pregnant and not stopped their medication. And the good news is it doesn't seem that at the doses that we use with disease-modifying therapies that any adverse effects have happened. Of course, if someone's on chemotherapy, then it becomes a more critical issue. If someone's on gelenia, it may take longer than a month to really get the white count back to normal, and so that might be an issue as well. And those information on the particular drugs should be something that you should talk to your neurologist about. Now, more often, people will stop their medications and they won't get pregnant within the month. And so then what do you do? And, of course, it's kind of an awkward position to be in, because you get more and more nervous, and then maybe it's harder to achieve the pregnancy. But I usually tell people that if they're doing okay, and particularly if their MS has been relatively well controlled and they haven't had relapses on medication, then it's probably okay to stay off the medication. If it gets to about 3 months and the pregnancy is still not happening, then at that point in time, the choice is, of course, to keep trying. Go back to the OBGYN and say, you know, is there anything else that we should be looking at, you know, problems achieving pregnancy, or even to get an MRI. At that time, with gadolinium, if you're sure you're not pregnant, and you know, see what the MRI looks like. Is there any activity? Could there be any silent progression? If there is, then maybe going back and, you know, using medication for a few more months to get things calmed down and then try it again might be reasonable. So there's a lot of different ways to do this, and a lot of it is going to depend on how active your MS is at the time you're considering getting pregnant. The corollary to that is, when do I start my medications after I deliver? And knowing what we do because of that PRIMS trial, we know that the peak risk, and it doesn't mean you're going to get a relapse, but the peak risk of relapse is at 3 months. It's really difficult to know if that's going to be you. Are you going to get it before 3 months? Are you going to get it after 3 months? And my rule of thumb is that people are going to do after MS, people with MS are going to do after delivery kind of the way they did before delivery. So if you have a very active MS, then chances are it's going to be very active afterwards, and I would get back on disease-modifying therapy as soon as possible. And I'll give you an example. We had a patient who was having a lot of relapses, and she was not well controlled on her medication, and decided to become pregnant. And she did really great during pregnancy, but because she was so active, the minute she delivered, she went back on her disease-modifying therapy. So, and she didn't breastfeed. Now, for the majority of people, it's fine to breastfeed, and most people want to breastfeed, and the American College of OBGYN recommends breastfeeding for a year. But with MS, again, it's going to be tough, and for most of my patients, I recommend breastfeeding for 6 weeks and then weaning the baby off breastfeeding and then back on disease-modifying therapy, because sometimes she'll have to start, with a quarter dose, half dose, three-quarter dose, or start other medications, and it may take time to achieve the control that you want before 3 months comes up. If people are really adamant, and again, it's a personal decision and one you make with your doctor, if people are adamant about wanting to breastfeed for a year, there are some options to do that too. One is to, for example, do an MRI at 3 months. Again, with gadolinium, and you can use that if you don't breastfeed for 24 hours and express that milk. And then you'll be fine to, a day later to go back to breastfeeding. And if it looks like your MRI is active, if it looks like there's new lesions, enhancing lesions, then you may want to look at the decision again. And some people might say, I'll breastfeed until I have a relapse. But that can be dangerous because you don't really know what your relapse is going to be like. Maybe it's something mild, and maybe it isn't. One thing that we do know, in case people do get relapses, and some people do during pregnancy, it's rare, but they can, or they may get a relapse when they're breastfeeding, and it's okay to use steroids during that time. A lot of it is going to depend, the recommendations are going to be made depending on what your MS is like, how aggressive it is, and how active it is. The fact that the medicine is not teratogenic doesn't necessarily mean that you should stay on it. In fact, because pregnancy seems to be an immune-protected state, you should do fine without the medications, and I wouldn't recommend staying on any medications during pregnancy because you really don't know if they're going to have an effect on the child, and pregnancy seems to be an immune-protected state, as we just talked about. Having said that, what I'd like to do now is just take a minute to talk about hormone changes in general, and I think some people were interested in the effects of hormones on multiple sclerosis. And again, it seems that when estrogen changes during the menstrual period, people might be at risk to get a relapse, or perhaps their MS is just a little worse. So some women have told me that in the days before their menstrual period. Maybe their walking gets a little bit worse, or their fatigue gets a little bit worse. And that actually is a fairly well documented potential effect. Sometimes the answer is to not have a period, and of course it takes, if you're on an oral contraceptive, sometimes continuing the oral contraceptive, for example, some of these that you take 3 months off on and 1 month off and have a period, can actually help those particular symptoms. Pregnancy, we talked about. Menopause, again, there doesn't seem to be any studies, any really good large postmenopausal studies, but again, you would lose the worsening around the time of your hormonal change because your hormones are steady, again, low but steady. So with that, and that's this is kind of concludes my first comments, what I wanted to talk about with pregnancy. And in a minute, I'm going to ask Alma to open this up for questions and answers. And then we're going to address a second topic after this, which will be dealing with the demands of motherhood then and things like fatigue, et cetera. Alma, are there any questions and questions for us right now?
Ladies and, yes, ma'am. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if you have a question, please press the number one key on your phone. Again, if there's any questions that you would like to ask, please press the number one key on your phone now. Our first question is from Katie. Katie, go ahead.
I was currently taking Copaxone, and when I found out I was pregnant, I got off of it. And my neurologist told me to go back on it the beginning of my third trimester, and then it would be okay to stay on it through breastfeeding also. So I just am wondering what you think about that.
Thank you, Katie, for that question. I think there's been some literature stating that Copaxone is safer than other medications during pregnancy or during breastfeeding, and I cannot agree with that, and I think that none of the disease-modifying therapies is quote-unquote okay during pregnancy and breastfeeding. And if you looked at any of the package inserts, it would say for any drug, and that includes aspirin, only use if the benefit outweighs the risk. And again, as I said before, typically in pregnancy, this is an immune-protected state. So I know the idea is to kind of build up a kind of level, and that's why they said, oh, it's okay to take Copaxone during the third trimester and during breastfeeding. But I think we all need to remember that what comes out in the breast milk goes right to the fetus, and what you're doing is really, in a sense, manipulating your child's immune system. We have no idea how much gets expressed in breast milk. We really don't know, you know, again, does this medication exert the same effect on a child's immune system it does in yours? But I think it would be safe to say that it does. And so since we haven't done any clinical trials on safety in infants, and we won't. It's there are a lot of ethical concerns on doing any clinical trials on women who are pregnant with medications, and we're certainly not going to do it with infants. I think that's still something that I can't recommend. But thank you for your question. Any other questions?
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have any questions, please press the number one key on your phone. Again, if you have any questions, press the number one key on your phone now. There are no further questions in queue.
Okay, I'm going to kind of continue here and talk a little bit about a second topic dealing with the demands of motherhood and dealing with fatigue. I think, again, some of these questions are probably things to bring up if you have MS. And, of course, even if you don't have MS, I think the demands of an infant and toddlers and children are huge, especially in this day and age where, you know, not only, you know, is the infant and toddler very active, but also, you know, as your child gets to be school age, you've got the school, you've got your extracurricular activities, you've got a lot to keep up with. And fatigue, of course, is a huge problem with women with multiple sclerosis. You've got this overwhelming fatigue of MS. It's not just being tired, it's not being sleepy, it's just sometimes feeling like you're slogging through molasses. So if that's an issue, you know, even when you're not pregnant, you know, imagine what it's going to be like afterwards when you're really running after a little child. Whatever we've said about fatigue with MS, even if it doesn't relate to MS, will be particularly important or especially important once you've had children, and that's to pace yourself. And sometimes it's almost a superhuman effort to think about doing that and having a child, because especially if you're going to breastfeed and maybe you're up every 2 to 3 hours, how on earth are you going to get the sleep that you need to really prevent relapses? And many of us that have done MS clinically for many, many years know that sometimes burning the candle at both ends, for example, shorting yourself on sleep, might put you at risk for getting relapses. And, you know, even if you're like a college student studying for exams and you're not sleeping much, that could be a risk factor for having a relapse. So pacing yourself is even more important if you're a young mom and you've got MS. Getting to sleep nights is very important, and whether that means expressing breast milk and having your other half feed the child at night, or maybe even breastfeeding as a decision if you're just completely and utterly exhausted, I think you should not feel guilty about that, and really have a frank conversation with your husband, with your significant other, with your family, and with yourself, and just say, can I really do this, and do I need help, and what can I do? And for example, sometimes it'll mean not going back to work at 3 months. If you have a job and you're going to take leave, it might mean that you're going to do it for a year. And most people kind of line up their support system before they get pregnant as well. It's really great, and you're lucky if you have your folks, your in-laws, people that are very interested in helping you. And sometimes it doesn't work out like that. Sometimes you're on the other coast or something like that. But even if you don't have immediate family there, arranging for family to be there at least during the first several months after delivery is probably a good idea. Getting your house ready so you don't have to do major changes after you have a baby or in your third trimester is a good idea. Even good friends and family, and trying to arrange some sort of support, or having a baby shower where someone says, oh, well, your gift is, 3 hours of babysitting every Friday night. That just sounds like such a great night. Would be such a great gift for that night. Would be something to ask for. And it's important, I think, once you have the baby, also to make sure that your spouse or your significant other is really not left by the wayside. I mean, you may indeed ask yourself, are there going to be relationship issues if I bring a new child into the family? And, you know, once again, MS doesn't, you know, have the corner on this issue. I mean, all couples are going to have to readjust demands and your focus. However, if you've got MS, you might be too tired to spend with your husband, let's say. But if that's the case, I think you really have to plan for that, because You don't want it to be a negative thing. And you might plan something like a date night, and I think that's always a good thing to do. There was, in some of the pre-questions, I think there were questions about, is there any other obvious support network? You know, should we try co-parenting with another couple, things like that? And, you know, again, I think the most important question is this going to work for you? Is having a family going to work for you? Is having kids going to work for you? Do you want them? How many do you want? And for most people, it's not going to be an issue. It should be asked independently of whether you have MS. And then afterwards, when you say, yeah, I really want kids, then decide, you know, how with your MS are you going to deal with it? So you get ready for all possibilities, including, let's say, if you did have a relapse, who could take care of the baby for you, if you had to come in and get steroids and things like that. Otherwise, these get into the realm of social questions, and I think that co-parenting, looking for alternative ways to raise your child, are social issues. They're really not medical issues, and once again, I'll leave that question for the families and to bring up with your own physician. Fatigue, though, is the bottom line. I think I'm going to circle back to what we started with. Even if you don't have MS, fatigue is an issue in about 70% of persons with MS. And once you get pregnant, a lot of people are really lucky if during the second trimester they feel really, really great. Typically in the first trimester, people don't feel really, really great. I mean, you can sometimes have morning sickness, a lot of nausea, you're busy increasing your fluid volume. Second trimester, people get this burst of energy. Third trimester, you're starting to gain weight, you know, maybe you're a little bit ungainly when you walk, things like that. There's a couple of things. Again, stack your deck. You take care of yourself prior to the pregnancy. You take care of yourself during the pregnancy. And most women really want to do this. They stop any medications they're on. They're taking folic acid. They're taking prenatal vitamins. You're not drinking coffee or alcohol. You're not smoking. But the one thing also that you could do is add exercise. And you should probably do this before pregnancy if you're considering getting pregnant. And the exercise that is going to help you the most are going to be things like yoga, stretching exercises, and sometimes there are classes specifically for moms who are pregnant in a lot of gyms, for example. So anything that will make you more mobile, make you more limber, is going to be a good thing. And maybe if you don't have a gym or you don't have time to exercise, even talking to a physical therapist or getting a personal trainer who knows about pregnancy and exercise would be a good idea. So I can't emphasize the stretching exercises enough. A lot of people like to do aerobics. I don't necessarily recommend anything strenuous, particularly at the third trimester, but the stretches, absolutely, and it'll make delivery a whole lot easier. So with that, that kind of ends my my second topic there. And if anybody has any questions on any of the social aspects, or you want to bring up any other questions that have to do with fatigue, I'll ask Alma to open the phone lines now for a just mini Q&A if anybody would like to expand on this topic or ask anything else about it. Alma, any questions on this topic?
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have any questions, please press the number one key on your phone. Ms. Lucas, there are no questions in queue.
Okay, thank you. So I would like to kind of round this up and talk a little bit about other medications during pregnancy. And again, most people will quit taking medications when they're pregnant, and For each individual medication, however, there's going to be medications that are safe to use during pregnancy if you have to use them, and medications that are safer than others when you're breastfeeding. And I don't have time to address each medication in detail, but there is a lot of data out there that talks about medications and whether they pass through breast milk. For example, we're not supposed to use anti-inflammatories like naproxen or aspirin or Aleve during pregnancy, because if you use it while you're trying to get pregnant, it can interfere with implantation and it can interfere with getting pregnant. If you use non-steroidal anti-inflammatories like ibuprofen, Aleve, aspirin at late in pregnancy, it can interfere with closure of the ductus arteriosus, which is a cardiovascular issue for a newborn. However, ibuprofen and Aleve, they don't pass through breast milk. So Aleve and ibuprofen are pretty reasonable. The benefit will outweigh the risk many times when you're breastfeeding if you want to take the anti-inflammatories then. Baclofen, for example, not recommended, neither is tizanidine during pregnancy. Sometimes if people are taking epilepsy drugs because they have seizures, there are some that are safer than others, but again, it's a benefit outweighing a risk, because the risk of a seizure, if you fall and hurt yourself, if you have a prolonged seizure, obviously the benefit of taking the drug may outweigh the risk. Anti-nausea drugs, if people are vomiting a lot or have nauseated and you're starting to lose weight the first trimester particularly, taking some of the anti-nausea drugs like Zofran or Ondansetron, those seem to be safe and probably the preferred drug to use as anti-nausea during the first trimester, although some people have used sparingly drugs like Phenergan or Reglan during pregnancy. For those of you that may have migraine headaches, typically the migraine drugs such as Imitrex or Maxalt that you may have heard of in the past, they were contraindicated during pregnancy. However, the American College of Pediatrics has approved them for during breastfeeding, and many neurologists feel that used sparingly, they're okay to use during the pregnancy as well. If the alternative is a medication that could be an opiate or a narcotic, used sparingly, again, that might be okay, but it's certainly not going to be okay if you use it a lot. Once again, to hopefully turn around and tie this back to the beginning, once you decide that you'd like to be a mom, that you want to achieve pregnancy, that you optimize your health as much as you can, taking folic acid at least a milligram a day, taking your vitamin D, hopefully being the right weight to height ratio, maybe doing a little stretching. Really, pregnancy should be an immune-protected state, and people should improve during pregnancy. Doesn't mean 100% that that'll happen, but it typically, for most of my patients, has been just fine. And after pregnancy, I have the same conversation that I talked about over the phone. Usually, and again, it's a big usually, 6 weeks is the breastfeeding time that I recommend. And part of that has to do with the baby's own metabolism. Typically, a fetal and newborn liver takes about 6 weeks before the fetus starts cranking out its own immunoglobulins, and before that really kind of depends on mom. So the antibody protection, for example, getting viruses or bacteria for the first 6 weeks, you usually depend on mom's antibodies and her resistance. And after that, the baby starts making antibodies on its own. So 6 weeks is kind of a minimum, unless someone's MS is very, very active. And then after that, you know, it's the impossible that you pace yourself, you get enough sleep, you don't get yourself get over fatigued, you have a lot of family and social support, you arrange to optimize your relationships and have some date nights if you can, and you know, again, as the child starts getting older, you're going to face the question, should I have a second child, and what's that going to do? And again, ask, and then mostly it's going to involve support systems and how are you going to deal with two kids now or three kids. So that's pretty much the formal part of my comments. And I'm going to ask Alma if there's any final questions during the Q&A.
Again, ladies and Ms. Lucas, Dr. Lucas?
Mm-hmm.
Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if you have any questions, please press the number one key on your phone. Dr. Lucas, there are no questions in queue at this time.
Thank you, Alma. And the one last thing I'd like to leave everyone with is basically a question to you. For those of you out there who may be moms already, is there a comment that you'd like to make to our audience, to particularly mothers-to-be? And if there are any,
there are no questions.
Operator know.
There are no questions in queue, Dr. Lucas.
Okay, and no comments either, I take it. So, well, with that, thank you very much, Alma. Thank you for running the Q&A. Thank you for the questions that you had, especially the wonderful questions that you sent us early that allowed us to design our talk just to be able to address what you wanted to hear. And I hope you'll participate in future topics. And once again, thank you very much and have a good evening.